All right, if I had fake Sean Connery with me right now, I would have him do the little Shakespeare bit of "This is the winter of our discontent." We'll see if I remember.
Now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this sun of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried, now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures.
Hey there, Rich Outfield here, and you're listening to the Rich Outcast. I am making that traditional drive from the cabin. There's about a mile before the dirt road becomes so rough, so literally washboard, well, not literally, so stereotypically washboard-like that I have to stop recording. It makes noises like this. Listen. But boy, it's cold. And boy, it's early. It's nearly dark, yet I left about 10 minutes earlier than I did last week. And it's cold. Easily 10 degrees, 15 degrees colder than it was last week. And last week I had a little bit of a respite from the winter-like atmosphere, the winter-like environs. But I borrowed the truck last week because there was so much snow. And here, this part where I am right now, probably I'll have to cut it out because it's super loud. The back of the truck started fishtailing. I started actually sliding backwards. I had to switch to four-wheel drive to get up this very, very small incline. The darkness bothers me because it's inconvenient, and it's also dangerous because there are still deer and they tend to congregate around the road or cross the road at this time of day. But the cold, I hate the cold so much that I view the winter as my enemy. And maybe I can put this out in the coldest, darkest part of the year as my ode to the winter season. My cousin was born in Alaska, and Alaska is renowned for its cold, for the summer, when the sun hardly goes down, the winter when the sun hardly comes up. And he somehow acclimatized to that, and he feels quite the opposite as I do about the winter and the summer. Once things start warming up, the end of March, beginning of April, he's like, oh no, here comes summer. And that's what I'm feeling right now, although, boy, I'm really feeling like it's already winter. There was a semi-melted layer of ice on the lake, and I looked at the thermometer and I thought, well, it's above freezing and it has been all day. Why is there still ice on the lake? And somebody smart could explain that to me. But when I'm recording this, Halloween is over, the high point of the fall for me. And I suppose Christmas is the high point of winter for me. But yeah, there's this big stretch after Christmas where it feels like there's nothing to look forward to. I have my writer's conference in February that I do always look forward to. And last year, Marshall Latham joined me, and he's still talking about joining me this year. So that's something to look forward to, but it is tough. My mom and I both suffer from that seasonal melancholy that you get when the leaves die and you start thinking about if maybe they have the right idea. And yet, you know, right around Christmas time, the days begin their inevitable march towards springtime, summertime, where, you know, each day is a little bit longer than the day before. Whereas right now, each day is shorter than the one before. And boy, I dread that. It's it's something that I wish I could get over. And if you're not like me as far as that goes, the seasons, etc., I wonder if it just seems stupid. You know, I have a disdain for very superstitious people. People who, you know, think that the number 13 is dangerous, that gasp and cross their legs tightly at the idea of the number 666. You know, that sort of thing. It seems dumb to me. And I apologize if I've just insulted something that you are a big believer in. But come on. You know, at the same time, I guess I have a little bit of OCD with numbers. I like 666 because it's three of the same number. And I like three of the same number always. Whenever I'm pumping gas, I want to get the numbers all the same. And when I got my very first television, which was in 1995, I think it was August 1995, I, for some reason, had this idea that the volume always had to be on an even number. I'm not sure where that came from, but it's all these years later, and it's still, if I'm in the room and like one of the kids turns up the volume and they turn it up to like 19 or 27 or something like that, it bothers me. I always think, gosh, could you just turn it up one more? Isn't that strange? Anyway, I don't suppose that I have a good subject to talk to you about today. The winter of our discontent, that's what I was thinking about here. And a couple of weeks from now, probably, it will be too snowy or too cold to go to the cabin. We tend to winterize once it gets below a certain temperature, where we empty out all the water in the toilets and in the pipes. We put antifreeze in there. We shut all that down. And we say goodbye for 6 or 7 months. And I feel sad because it's been so great having this cabin. And I didn't really take advantage of it for so long. The first time I ever came up by myself, I think, was 2016. Whereas before, it always felt like it's someplace to go with the family. Because I had never been up by myself, I didn't know how everything worked. How do you turn on the gas? How do you turn the little, is it a flue, on the fireplace so that the heat goes outward instead of up the chimney, et cetera, et cetera. But my dad died in 2016, and I started spending more and more time there at the cabin because it was a resource. It was something that, and maybe I had gone up the year before and realized that I could write or that I could edit audio or something like that without interruption, without distraction, and be able to focus. And a lot of writing instructors will tell you, you need to find a place where you can write, and always write there, and don't do other things there, because you can train your brain like you are Pavlov's dog or something like that, that every time it goes to this place, it starts thinking creatively. It starts thinking, oh, I'm here, I must need to write now. And I'm sure that that is overly simplistic, and that probably only works for half of the people. And for half of those people, it probably only works a third of the time. But that's what the cabin ended up being for me. And 2 weeks ago, it snowed, and I was a little bit worried that I might get stuck in the snow. And so last week, I borrowed my dad's truck, and I guess it's my mom's truck now. But my brother-in-law has sort of claimed it, and he can be such a dick about it that there have been times when I've been tempted to say, oh, is it your truck? I didn't realize that. Oh, does it belong to you? It's not my dad's truck or my mom's truck. It's your truck. Oh, okay. Because, you know, he resents when I tell, well, he resents everything. And I resent everything back. And it's a vicious circle. Sorry, we've already run that episode. But I borrowed the truck last week because I still wanted to come up here. And my mom said, yes, you can borrow the truck, but maybe you shouldn't go, you know? It's cold and there's snow. And what if you get stuck? And I thought, well, but that's what I have the truck for. You know, I just had decided that I wanted to go badly enough that it was worth the effort of cleaning out the back of the truck of fishing poles and such, and putting my stuff in it and driving down and getting gas. And I was shocked, almost bowled over at how much money it cost to fill the tank. Wow, it cost me so much to go down to the cabin. Wow. But I've trained my brain that the cabin is where I do editing. The cabin is where I do writing. And so even though it cost me a lot of money, it was worth it to me. Yes, it hurt to see that much money go on my credit card when I was filling the tank. But I got some stuff done. I was happy that I went. And I'm happy that I went this time, and I will miss it. When this episode comes out, I will hear this part and go, yeah, I do miss it. Okay, but let me say a tiny bit about that, about training your brain to do something. You know, I've trained myself that when I go to the cabin, I edit audio, I write, I blog, I record. You know, these are things that I do for my creative outlets. And maybe it was last year, maybe it was the year before, I started checking out DVDs from the library to take up to the cabin to watch as entertainment at night. And dollars to donuts, I will feel guilty about doing that. I will either pause it and say, oh shoot, I need to go edit for a few minutes, or oh, I haven't gotten my writing done, you know, that kind of thing. And that's good that I have so trained myself that the cabin is a place for creativity. The cabin is the place for creation, for producing rather than consuming, that it dampens my enjoyment of just vegging out or whatever. And there have been many times when I've considered, you know, I should buy like an Xbox 360 or something like that. You can get them super, super cheap. And I'll just have it up at the cabin and I'll be able to catch up on these games that I never got to play. You know, at this point, probably an Xbox One is super cheap. But I never do it because I think I would feel too guilty. I'm only there on Wednesdays and Thursdays. And maybe once every summer, I have nothing on Friday and I can stay an extra day. It usually happens once. But I know that I would feel so guilty. It's like I could have written something. If I hadn't bought this Xbox or I hadn't been playing this game, who knows if those games would even work up at some place where there's no internet? Don't answer that question. It's better that I don't know. So I go there and my mind tries to go to a creative place. It also feels more free at the cabin. I don't have any qualms about talking to myself, doing voices, singing. You know, the things that I wouldn't do at the house because there's probably somebody around. What if somebody heard me? What if somebody, what would they think? Et cetera, et cetera. I don't feel those qualms. This place is kind of my castle. And when I go there with other people, which this year only happened twice, the summer and fall, there were only two occasions when there were other people. I don't feel like it's my place. I feel like I am stifled. But creativity is complicated. It's not just a switch that you can flip on and off or a bell that you can ring. In Pavlov's case, it is, I can't speak for you. I will speak for me. Being somewhere where it's just like, okay, you now have 15 minutes to write, write. Sometimes you can't turn it on. Sometimes you can't just be creative. Kind of like this podcast, I said, I'm going to record something on the way home. I don't have an agenda. I don't have a topic. We will find out as I go what my topic is, which is, it's dumb because, I mean, it's going to be more rambly than ever. And I don't have a point that I'm building toward. This is probably not going to be one of the stronger episodes. But you can't force yourself to be creative. And during that two-year stretch when I wrote every single day, there were times when it's just like, oh, shoot, what am I going to do? What am I going to write? And I would waste a lot of time trying to come up with ideas, just spitballing sometimes. What if I wrote a story about a kid who could make hair grow? You know, that seems very, very limited, but there's a lot of money in hair restoration. And you could make girls grow mustaches as a mean prank. And a third thing. And so I would write that kind of thing and be like, boy, this is not good. And I'd feel like I had wasted my time. Now, if you're a better writer than I am, maybe you don't do that. But again, just like the people who hate summer and love the winter,
the bastards.
We're not all the same. And as writers, we're not all the same. And the worst writing instructor in the world will tell you this is how everybody should write. This is how everybody should approach creativity. I have had for 20-something years now, I guess since the year 2000, tried to do an October scary story. And this year, 2023, I didn't manage it. I thought of a couple of ideas that wouldn't be bad, but I didn't succeed in writing one. And I'm not too disappointed in myself. I hadn't set it as a goal. There was that time when there was the old guy that I met on the dam who said, next time I see you, you need to have written a good story. And there was a little bit of pressure there because I felt like maybe my soul was on the line. And you know what? I never shared that story with you. I never shared it with anybody. I guess I could. Maybe I'll set that as a goal for 2024.
Oh, hell no.
Although there's so many times when I say, maybe I'll set this as a goal for the new year. And by the time the new year comes around, I don't remember it. And so I don't. But like the October scary stories, there have been years when I've said, okay, I'm going to write a story for Christmas. And I'll try and do that this year. I should have set it as a goal, but I didn't do it. But I can do it. And I'll try and think of stuff. But it's the same sort of thing. You can try to force yourself to write a good Christmas story. And maybe if you have enough power over your own will, you can force yourself to write a Christmas story, but will it be good? Will inspiration strike? You can't force inspiration to strike. Although I'm sure there are writing instructors who say you can. That if you do it enough, you can make yourself write something good. We all have our own tastes too. And if I wrote something that I thought was super, super good, you may not agree. You may not feel that way. I recently put that Stephen King story, Weeds, out on YouTube. And as far as I know, it's still there, but it might not be. Sometimes his people will have stuff removed, and that's fine. But I get informed when there are comments on the videos. And on the Weeds video, somebody commented, King is the biggest hack writer in the world. Or something like that, you know, the biggest hack ever. And you may feel that way too. You may groan every time, well, every year when I say I'm going to do a Stephen King story. And that's fine. We all feel something different. There's that line, that part in When Harry Met Sally, when Harry has tried to set up his best friend Jess with Sally Albright because he loves both of them. And if they could hit it off, wouldn't that be great? And he drops a line from his favorite writer, Jess does, and Sally's just like, ugh, you know, what a hack. And Jess says, well, he's the reason that I became a writer, but yeah, let's not dwell on that. Everybody has different tastes as far as that stuff goes. And for some reason, I'm reminded of when I was on the set of Flags of Our Fathers. And we were in very cramped quarters because it was actually on a ship. And so everybody was forced to sit together. And I've talked about it before, right? It was my favorite experience in all the time in LA that I did extra work. And yeah, if you want, you can say I hate LA there, but I don't. But yeah, we were all stuck together on this ship once it left at dawn and it came back at dusk because we were trying, because Clint Eastwood, who was the director, wanted as much daylight as possible. And when the daylight was gone, we were done for the day. And I worked on it, I think, 3 days, but it could have been four. But we were all stuck together with strangers, and I got to interact with the cast, which I thought was really, really neat. Didn't get to talk to Eastwood, but I was next to this kid, like an 18, 19-year-old kid, and he was talking about, I can't wait to be able to go and see this movie in the theater and see myself. And I said, you know, it sounds like you're just barely getting into extra work. And he's like, yeah, this is like my second gig. And I said, don't get your hopes too high, because a lot of times you can watch the television show, you can watch the movie, and even though you worked on it, even though you recognize the scene that you worked in, you don't see you. You don't show up. They didn't use a take where they can see you. And especially if you like tell all your family to watch it or whatever, it can be as disappointing as like those terrible Matrix sequels. And the kid looked at me and he's like, what? You don't like the Matrix sequels? And I said, no, they're terrible. And he says, you're joking. I said, no. And he says, I've never heard somebody say that before. Those are the greatest movies I've ever seen. I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for those movies. And I think he meant pursuing a career in film. And I, you know, if you want to be cynical, you can have me make quotation marks in the air when I say career. But hey, all of us were paid to work on that movie, and we got to hang around with Clint Eastwood and Paul Walker and Adam Beach and Ryan Phillippe and Robert Patrick, you know, people that I admired. Well, not Ryan Phillippe, but he was in I Know What You Did Last Summer. So there's that. But I had hurt this guy's feelings, this kid's feelings. And I said, look, surely you've heard people don't like the Matrix sequels before. And he hadn't. I guess he was very young, or the circles that he went in, it came out at a time when it was, when he was 16 or something like that, and it was so groundbreaking or life-changing for him that I almost apologized for not liking those movies. And here's the thing. The first sequel is not bad. It has really, really good moments in it. But it's too long and it's too drawn out. And there's that one scene that's insanely boring. The third one, there's just no excuse for. The third one just sucks. And yeah, it's, not to get off on a tangent, but I feel that way about the Star Wars prequels. And I know that there are millions of people who feel differently, who absolutely adore those movies and resent the hell out of people like me that hate them. In the same way as I resent the hell out of the Last Jedi haters that won't shut up about the Last Jedi. That was a tangent. This whole episode's a tangent, isn't it? Everybody's taste is different. I can force myself to write a Christmas story. I can force myself to write a Halloween story. But whether it is a good story or not is debatable. And so the best I can do is put myself in a situation and in places where I am encouraged to be creative, where I am open to inspiration. It's almost like religion. You know what I mean? I have family members that are very, very religious, and they will say that if you go to a certain place, that you will be closer to God or the angels or to the departed. And if you open yourself up to it, you will feel that you're not alone, kind of thing. Did I describe that adequately? We used to do contests, writing contests, on the Doonstief. I feel like we did 3 of them, but we might have done more than that. We might have done 5 or 6. Well, we would do the triple word score stories, the broken mirror stories. Was there a third thing? I can't remember. But every single one of those that we did, let's say that there were 5, I would make myself enter the contest. I would make myself write a story to the prompt. And there were a couple of them, like somebody goes into town, finds everybody is exactly the same, where I wrote multiple entries for them. And boy, I'm not sure that I ever ran any of those on either of the podcasts. Maybe that's something that I can do, that I could unearth and run on here. Remind me, maybe I'll do it. I did not win the first contest, even though I entered multiple times. And I did not win the second contest. I can't remember if I wrote more than one on that one or not. And if we did a third contest, I lost that one as well. But the fourth contest, I wrote The Calling. Telephone rings. The person on the other end only says one word, but it is enough. And that story turned out really, really good, and I won the contest. But, you know, winning your own contest always feels disingenuous to me. Is it disingenuous? Is that the word I want?
No.
Disingenuine. Is that the word I want?
Hell no, Rish Outfield.
It never feels quite the same as winning somebody else's contest. But I'm super proud of that story. And I had X number of days to write it in, to come up with an idea and write it. It's not a story that I had carried around for a good long time. And you know what? I did write another telephone rings, person says one word story, and I did submit it, and that one lost. But I did it under a pseudonym. Well, maybe they were all under pseudonyms. Maybe they had blind judges. But I think that the very last contest that we did, that was the triple word score, where everybody was assigned words at random, and I won that one as well. And I don't think that it was as good a story as The Calling, but it was good, according to me. Of course, your mileage Your kilometrage may vary, mate. But it's not always easy to sit down and say, I have to write right now. I have to be creative. It has to be good. Sometimes you can't. Over at the Journey Into podcast, they've done contests. And I have written a story for every single one. Although now I'm thinking that there was one that I skipped. Well, let's proceed under the impression that I have entered every single one. Sometimes you just can't come up with a good enough idea in the time that is before you. And in the one where they did Journey Into blank contest, where you had to write a story that was titled Journey Into, I came up with an idea that was too big. I don't think I finished it in time. I never submitted it to Journey Into. I ran it on this show. I guess what I'm saying is that you can't always just call up creativity, and you can't always write something great. The person that said Stephen King is the biggest hack alive, or whatever they said, I become Jess from When Harry Met Sally's. Like, that guy is the reason that I'm a writer today. But I was thinking when I ran Weeds that it would be super fun to either make a YouTube video or do it on my podcast of putting together a Stephen King collection where it was all my favorite stories by him. Let's say the 20, or, you know, 13. Oh, that's a good number. Best Stephen King stories. And so in my head, I was going through his first three collections. And Night Shift alone has enough that I could probably put 10 in. And Skeleton Crew has enough that I could probably put 8 or 9 in. And Nightmares and Dreamscapes probably has 7 or 8 in it that I would put in his best work lists. But then King continued to write, and he continued to put out short story collections. And there are almost no stories from those later collections that I would put in the best 25 Stephen King stories. He changed the way that he wrote. And the magic doesn't come in the same way that it did when he was young. And I feel that that's terrible. That's very sad. But it goes right hand in hand with what I'm talking about. He still has a super fertile imagination. Back in the 80s, somebody said that Stephen King had the greatest imagination of our time, or something like that. And they'd put it on the cover of books, this quote. And he may still have the greatest imagination of our time. And I've heard him talk about ideas that he has that he hasn't put into stories yet. The one that comes to mind was he wrote this nonfiction book with, no, Delbert Grady was the caretaker at the Overlook Hotel. And no, in fact, you are the caretaker at the Overlook Hotel. You've always been the caretaker at the hotel. I want to say that it was, his name was Onan. Stuart Onan, does that sound right?
I don't know, I'm just an announcer.
He wrote this nonfiction book about the Red Sox, and it happened to be the year that they won the pennant. And one little bit where King is talking, he said he was watching a Red Sox game, and they showed the group of spectators behind the catcher, and he thought he recognized one of the people that was sitting there. And he had, by the way, I know I've told this story before, bear with me. Okay? You're going to get reruns when it's just free association. Okay? King thought that he recognized somebody sitting there. And then he's just like, no, of course it's not so-and-so, because so-and-so is dead. And then as he was watching the game, he started to think about that idea. He's like, no. What if the person that I saw was that person that is dead? What if you were watching a baseball game and you saw somebody in the stands that you knew was dead watching the game? What if the next time you watched a baseball game, you saw another dead person sitting in the stands? Oh my gosh, maybe I'll write that as a story someday. And then he went on to talk about how the Sox did that day. And that part stuck with me more than all of the baseball talk in the whole book. By far. I just thought, what a brilliant idea for a story. Oh my gosh. And a couple of years later, a story by Stephen King called Face in the Crowd came out. And I knew what it was the second I saw the title, what it had to be. And I read the back of the flap, and yes, sure enough, this is that story. And I read it, and it didn't do anything for me. It was just the most brilliant idea for a story, and yet it didn't work for me. It wasn't a classic Stephen King story. The classic Stephen King stories are few and far between. And I can't say why he doesn't write the way that he used to, or his stories don't hit me the way that they used to. And I feel bad for saying that, because it's like I'm agreeing with the person who commented on that YouTube post video, but I'm not agreeing with him. Weeds, the story that I ran on here and put on YouTube, is a great story. And the stuff that he wrote, you know, between 1970 and 1980, the short stories are almost to a one excellent, excellent stories. Why?
I don't know!
Why those and not later stories? Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know!
Marcy, Margie, Marcery, Marjorie, Margot.
Margot.
That's who it is. I can force myself to write a Christmas story. I can force myself. Oh, okay, we're going back to winter. I can force myself to write a winter story. I can force myself to put out an episode called The Winter of My Discontent. But it doesn't mean that it's going to be good. And that's so frustrating, because you can put in the work and it still doesn't get you across the finish line. To bring us back to a baseball metaphor, baseball doesn't have a finish line. It has a home base. Right. Thank you for keeping me honest, Fake Sean. I'm not a sports guy. You can put in the work, but it doesn't mean that the end result will be great. And that is art. That is frustrating, but that's what it is. I often talk to you about, okay, twice. I've talked to you about this podcast that I listen to, that David Spade and Dana Carvey do together. And in the one that I listened to today, Spade is talking about bad episodes of Saturday Night Live. And he says, the audience may not know this, but a bad episode of Saturday Night Live takes just as much work to produce as a good one does. And he's like, I've made some bad movies. Believe me, we worked just as hard on those bad movies as we did on the good one. And that's profound. It's heartbreaking if you think about it. If you think about movies that aren't good, that people worked their butts off on. For some reason, I thought of Tomorrowland that Brad Bird did. The last live-action movie Brad Bird did was not very good. But I'm sure he worked just as hard on it as he did one of the movies that was great. And you could come up with other examples. But let me go to The Matrix Resurrection. No, is that what it's called? The Matrix Revolutions. the third Matrix movie. I'm sure that the Wachowski brothers, siblings, worked just as hard on that movie as they did on the first Matrix. And I think that it's terrible. You don't know. You can force yourself to do something. Ring that bell, Pavlov. But it doesn't mean that it will be great. Or even good. How frustrating is that, huh? You know, it's probably like sports. To keep the sports analogy going, I don't give a flying fig about sports. But often my brother-in-law will be watching SportsCenter, and you'll have these coaches or you'll have these players, and they'll say, you know, we made the plays, and they didn't work. They weren't good enough. They say a variation on the same thing every single time. But you don't know how well your team is going to play until they're on the court or the field or the third thing. And there are just so many factors. It's not science. You can't predict that if you throw the ball to so-and-so, he will make a three-pointer. You will win the game. Sometimes you miss. Sometimes it bounces off. Sometimes you airball. Doesn't mean that you didn't give it the same effort as you did the time that you won the game, that you won the championship, that you won the heart of that little girl. Writing is hard. Art is hard. Comedy is hard. Maybe that's why this is the winter of our discontent. Maybe podcasting is hard, and that's why bringing it back to that very tenuous through line didn't entirely work. But listen, I thank you for listening to me prattle on. I thank you for riding with me through these canyon roads back home. Now it's just completely dark. I thank you if you support me on Patreon. If you don't, consider it, please. I am grateful for the people that do support me. And I'm also grateful for the people who just listen. Thank you for your encouragement. Now get out there and win the game. Good night.
The Rish Outcast is presented under a Creative Commons Attribution, No Derivatives License. That license enables you to share the file with anyone, but not to charge for it or alter it. A license to kill, by the way, enables me to kill anyone I please, whenever I please. You judge.
And all the clouds that lowered upon our house, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house, in the deep bosom of the ocean buried.
You're still here. It's over. Go home. I think you have become accustomed to getting stuff at the end of an episode, like post-credits sequences, and it's awful to the point where when you don't get it, you feel ripped off somehow. What, I can't have it a short episode? Okay, well, if you've become accustomed to something, my lawyers say that you're entitled to it. So I present Washington Irving's The Adventures of the German Student.
The Adventure of the German Student by Washington Irving. Narrated by Rish Outfield. On a stormy night, in the tempestuous times of the French Revolution, a young German was returning to his lodgings at a late hour across the old part of Paris. The lightning gleamed, and the loud claps of thunder rattled through the lofty, narrow streets. But I should first tell you something about this young German. Gottfried Wolfgang was a young man of good family. He had studied for some time at Göttingen, but being of a visionary and enthusiastic character, he had wandered into those wild and speculative doctrines which have so often bewildered German students. His secluded life, his intense application, and the singular nature of his studies had an effect on both mind and body. His health was impaired, his imagination diseased. He had been indulging in fanciful speculations on spiritual essences until, like Swedenborg, he had an ideal world of his own around him. He took up a notion, I do not know from what cause, that there was an evil influence hanging over him, an evil genius or spirit seeking to ensnare him and ensure his perdition. Such an idea, working on his melancholy temperament, produced the most gloomy effects. He became haggard and desponding. His friends discovered the mental malady preying upon him and determined that the best cure was a change of scene. He was sent, therefore, to finish his studies amidst the splendors and gaieties of Paris. Wolfgang arrived at Paris at the breaking out of the Revolution. The popular delirium at first caught his enthusiastic mind, and he was captivated by the political and philosophical theories of the day. But the scenes of blood which followed shocked his sensitive nature, disgusted him with society and the world, and made him more than ever a recluse. He shut himself up in a solitary apartment in the Pies Latin, the quarter of students. There, in a gloomy street not far from the monastic walls of the Sorbonne, he pursued his favorite speculations. Sometimes he spent hours together in the great libraries of Paris, those catacombs of departed authors, rummaging among their hordes of dusty and obsolete works in quest of food for his unhealthy appetite. He was, in a manner, a literary ghoul, feeding on the charnel house of decayed literature. Wolfgang, though solitary and recluse, was of an ardent temperament. But for a time, though solitary and recluse, was of an ardent temperament. But for a time it operated merely upon his imagination. He was too shy and ignorant of the world to make any advances to the fair. But he was a passionate admirer of female beauty, and in his lonely chamber would often lose himself in reveries on forms and faces which he had seen, and his fancy would deck out images of loveliness far surpassing the reality. While his mind was in this excited and sublimated state, a dream produced an extraordinary effect upon him. It was of a female face of transcendent beauty. So strong was the impression made that he dreamt of it again and again. It haunted his thoughts by day, his slumbers by night. In fine, he became passionately enamored of this shadow of a dream. This lasted so long that it became one of those fixed ideas which haunt the minds of melancholy men and are at times mistaken for madness. Such was Gottfried Wolfgang, and such his situation at the time I mentioned. He was returning home late one stormy night, though some of the old and gloomy streets of the Marais, the ancient part of Paris. Of the Marais, the ancient part of Paris. The loud claps of thunder rattled among the high houses of the narrow streets. He came to the Place de Grève, the square where public executions are performed. The lightning quivered about the pinnacles of the ancient Hôtel de Ville and shed flickering gleams over the open space in front. As Wolfgang was crossing the square, he shrank back with horror at finding himself close by the guillotine. It was the height of the Reign of Terror, when this dreadful instrument of death stood ever ready, and its scaffold was continually running with the blood of the virtuous and the brave. It had, that very day, been actively employed in the work of carnage, and there it stood in grim array amidst a silent and sleeping city, waiting for fresh victims. Wolfgang's heart sickened within him, and he was turning, shuddering from the horrible engine, when he beheld a shadowy form cowering, as it were, at the foot of the steps which led up to the scaffold. A succession of vivid flashes of lightning revealed it more distinctly. It was a female figure, dressed in black, She was seated on one of the lower steps of the scaffold, leaning forward, her face hid in her lap, and her long, disheveled tresses hanging to the ground, streaming with the rain which fell in torrents. Wolfgang paused. There was something awful in this solitary monument of woe. The female had the appearance of being above the common order. He knew the time to be full of vicissitude, and that many a fair head, which had once been pillowed on down, now wandered houseless. Perhaps this was some poor mourner whom the dreadful axe had rendered desolate, and who sat here heartbroken on the strand of existence, from which all that was dear to her had been launched into eternity. He approached and addressed her in the accents of sympathy. She raised her head and gazed wildly at him. What was his astonishment at beholding, by the bright glare of the lightning, the very face which had haunted him in his dreams. It was pale and disconsolate, but ravishingly beautiful. Trembling with violent and conflicting emotions, Wolfgang again accosted her. He spoke something of her being exposed at such an hour of the night and to the fury of such a storm, and offered to conduct her to her friends. She pointed to the guillotine with a gesture of dreadful signification.
"I have no friend on earth," said she.
"But you have a home," said Wolfgang.
"Yes, in the grave."
The heart of the student melted at the words.
"If a stranger dare make an offer," said he, "without danger of being misunderstood, I would offer my humble dwelling as a shelter, myself as a devoted friend. I am friendless myself in Paris, and a stranger in the land. But if my life could be of service, it is at your disposal, and should be sacrificed before harm or indignity should come to you."
There was an honest earnestness in the young man's manner that had its effect. His foreign accent, too, was in his favor. It showed him not to be a hackneyed inhabitant of Paris. Indeed, there is an eloquence in true enthusiasm that is not to be doubted. The homeless stranger confided herself implicitly to the protection of the student. He supported her faltering steps across the Pont Neuf, and by the place where the statue of Henry IV had been overthrown by the populace. The storm had abated, and the thunder rumbled at a distance. All Paris was quiet. That great volcano of human passion slumbered for a while, to gather fresh strength for the next day's eruption. The student conducted his charge through the ancient streets of the Pays Latin, and by the dusky walls of the Sorbonne to the great dingy hotel which he inhabited. The old portress who admitted them stared with surprise at the unusual sight of the melancholy Wolfgang with a female companion. On entering his apartment, the student, for the first time, blushed at the scantiness and indifference of his dwelling. He had but one chamber, an old-fashioned saloon, heavily carved and fantastically furnished with the remains of former magnificence, for it was one of those hotels in the quarter of the Luxembourg Palace which had once belonged to nobility. It was lumbered with books and papers and all the usual apparatus of a student, and his bed stood in a recess at one end. When lights were brought, and Wolfgang had a better opportunity of contemplating the stranger, he was more than ever intoxicated by her beauty. Her face was pale, but of a dazzling fairness, set off by a profusion of raven hair that hung clustering about it. Her eyes were large and brilliant, with a singular expression approaching almost to wildness. As far as her black dress permitted her shape to be seen, it was of perfect symmetry. Her whole appearance was highly striking, though she was dressed in the simplest style. The only thing approaching to an ornament which she wore was a broad black band round her neck, clasped by diamonds. The perplexity now commenced with the student, how to dispose of the helpless being thus thrown upon his protection. He thought of abandoning his chamber to her and seeking shelter for himself elsewhere. Still, he was so fascinated by her charms, there seemed to be such a spell upon his thoughts and senses that he could not tear himself from her presence. Her manner, too, was singular and unaccountable. She spoke no more of the guillotine. Her grief had abated. The attentions of the student had first won her confidence, and then, apparently, her heart. She was evidently an enthusiast like himself, and enthusiasts soon understand each other. In the infatuation of the moment, Wolfgang avowed his passion for her. He told her the story of his mysterious dream and how she had possessed his heart before he had even seen her. She was strangely affected by his recital and acknowledged to have felt an impulse toward him equally unaccountable. It was the time for wild theory and wild actions. Old prejudices and superstitions were done away. Everything was under the sway of the goddess of reason. Among other rubbish of the old times, the forms and ceremonies of marriage began to be considered superfluous bonds for honorable minds. Social compacts were the vogue. Wolfgang was too much of a theorist not to be tainted by the liberal doctrines of the day. "Why should we separate?" said he. "Our hearts are united. In the eye of reason and honor, we are as one. What need is there of sordid forms to bind high souls together?" The stranger listened with emotion. She had evidently received illumination at the same school. "You have no home nor family," continued he. "Let me be everything to you, or rather, let us be everything to one another. If form is necessary, form shall be observed. There is my hand. I pledge myself to you forever."
"Forever?"
said the stranger solemnly.
"Forever,"
repeated Wolfgang. The stranger clasped the hand extended to her.
"Then I am yours," murmured she, and sank upon his bosom.
The next morning the student left his bride sleeping and sallied forth at an early hour to seek more spacious apartments suitable to the change in his situation. When he returned, he found the stranger lying with her head hanging over the bed and one arm thrown over it. He spoke to her, but received no reply. He advanced to awaken her from her uneasy posture. On taking her hand, it was cold. There was no pulsation. Her face was pallid and ghastly. In a word, she was a corpse. Horrified and frantic, he alarmed the house. A scene of confusion ensued. The police was summoned. As the officer of the police entered the room, he started back on beholding the corpse.
"Great heaven!" cried he. "How did this woman come here?"
"Do you know anything about her?"
said Wolfgang eagerly.
"Do I?"
exclaimed the police officer.
"She was guillotined yesterday."
He stepped forward, undid the black collar round the neck of the corpse, and the head rolled on the floor. The student burst into a frenzy.
The fiend has gained possession of me," shrieked he. "I am lost forever."
They tried to soothe him, but in vain. He was possessed with the frightful belief that an evil spirit had reanimated the dead body to ensnare him. He went distracted and died in a madhouse.
Okay, well, there you go. What, how old is that one? 1824? The reason I shared that with you is because on a recent episode I talked about The Velvet Ribbon, which was a story that delighted me as a child, and I looked it up to find out, you know, who wrote it and where it came from, and there's a modern version, but then it could be from Washington Irving's Adventures of the German Student. And so I thought, okay, well, I will sit down and read that. But I can't just sit down and read something. I always have to do it out loud. And then a lot of times, after I've done it out loud, I might as well share it with you. After all, there is nothing preventing me. So there you go. Oh, this was apparently one of those short stories that was later collected in novel form, where he would have two characters telling each other stories back and forth at sort of bookends. There's a name for it when you take various short stories and then present them as though they're a novel. And if you must know, this is how the story ends in that version.
He went distracted and died in a madhouse. Here, the old gentleman with the haunted head finished his narrative. And is this really a fact? Said the inquisitive gentleman.
A fact not to be doubted, replied the other. I had it from the best authority. The student told it to me himself. I saw him in a madhouse at Paris.
So there you go. I shared that with you as a bonus. Please don't get used to it. I can't guarantee that it will happen in every episode. There are going to be short episodes. But I do quite like the idea of someone discovering that the woman they have just been with is a ghost or is a corpse. I wrote my own version of a story like that 20-something years ago, and that's one that I don't think I've ever shared on the podcast. Of course, now that I presented this one, you'll think I was influenced by the adventure of the German student. But it doesn't matter. It's fine. We're all influenced by stuff, and even if we weren't, and we feel like this idea was solely mine, it's been done. There's nothing new under the sun. So that's it. For sure, I promise you, it's over. Good night.